Dr. Fairbairn has been a member of staff at Newcastle since 1978, and thus has the advantage over some of us of having seen his subject area change greatly over that time. His interests in cartography are also wide, ranging from the use of mapping for navigation purposes to quantifying the actual information content of historical mapping. Recent developments continue to change the art and or science of cartography, opening up many opportunities for GI researchers and professionals. David's current projects include work on generalisation, the interface between images and maps, and of course crowdsourcing, about which we will talk today.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming along, and it's always nice to come back to Edinburgh, and I say that as a Glaswegian. What we're talking about today is volunteer geographic information, and in particular, I've been interested over the past couple of years in how volunteer geographic information can be integrated with formal projects that are engaged in mapping in particular and collection of spatial data in general. So we're looking at the possible interaction between this informal data that's collected by citizens, by amateurs, by non-experts, however you like to define them, and the formal data that is collected by the official agencies such as Ordnance Survey, British Geological Survey, etc. And, of course, VGI is a bit of a buzzword these days, and it does reflect the fact that there has been significant amounts of data collected and put in the public domain that could be regarded as being collected manipulated and managed by amateurs, people who are not actually paid to do this kind of work. And so a number of examples of VGI data collection, and we'll try and see how that data collection can actually then be translated into useful geographic information and useful mapping. Flickr data sets, there are plenty of these. This one, I assume, must have come from the EDINA website, but there are plenty of collections of information, both of reality as it exists now and previous environments. Is there some way that we can use this rich visual source of spatial data to actually add some value to our understanding of historic Edinburgh in the year 1929, when these pictures were taken? And of course, if we move to the contemporary collections of imagery that are available on facilities such as Flickr, we've got hundreds and thousands, millions of images available for locations around the Earth. And it might be expected that the combination of all of these images of sites, all these images of locations and space, could somehow be used to either update or initiate the establishment of good quality spatial data sets for these kinds of locations. And some of you may well be familiar with Panoramio as well, which is another example of imagery data collected by the general public and collected together in a location that is available for perusal by anybody. So these kinds of images are available. Can we use them to construct environments, to construct models of reality that may be regarded as being geographical in their nature? And of course, some satellite data is also available in the public domain. It's possible to get high resolution, often old, but still potentially useful data from which you can, if you like, just trace off the imagery. You can use members of the public to volunteer their services to actually identify and collect information about space, about geography. And of course, the archetypical example of publicly sourced spatial data is OpenStreetMap, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with OpenStreetMap as a project. It has certain limitations, of course, and we'll discuss those in a moment, but it's clear that here we've got a large number of coordinated points collected by members of the public who have then submitted that data to a centralized facility and the ability to create mapping over extensive areas across the whole world is clearly evident in OpenStreetMap. This particular example is one that shows the fact that it's not only data from members of the public that's incorporated, there are other data sets here that have been integrated with OpenStreetMap, and you can actually see the distinction between the drainage pattern, which I assume came from the Institute of Hydrology or from some public domain data set, which is quite extensive in this area, but not over in this area. So there's variability, not only in the fact of the source of the data, but also in its coverage. And of course, with OpenStreetMap, this is a sophisticated enough system for us to be able to actually render the data in different forms. Okay, so here we've got one particular set of styles applied to OpenStreetMap data, and there we've got another set of styles applied to OpenStreetMap data. The focus of OpenStreetMap primarily is still the graphical representation, the map itself. That's what people use OpenStreetMap for, to actually get some graphical data. But of course, behind it, there's a whole range of information about that spatial data that's been collected. Information that you could regard as metadata. And here we are highlighting the building that we're in at the moment. And the list of information that actually exists about this data that's been collected is quite extensive. We've got some information about what type of feature it is, and its name and its purpose, and also an indication as to who actually collected the data. The person may even be in this room at this minute, but on the 29th of September 2010, somebody called James KS actually went ahead and edited and put their own information into this facility, and that's now part of the OpenStreetMap data. I mentioned that OpenStreetMap is a project that involves public collection of data, public collection of coordinates and attributes of those coordinates, but also some other data sources can be brought into OpenStreetMap and have been volunteered to OpenStreetMap for inclusion in the database. So here we've got an example of the center of an American city, and the detail is quite complex here, and one of the reasons is that the TIGER set of street-level data that is used by the US Census in order for them to make sure that they're counting every single person in the states, as they did last year, the TIGER set of data is a public domain data set which has been offered to OpenStreetMap as a project, and OpenStreetMap uses it to actually give us the street network for the United States. And so an extraordinarily high level of detail here from a data source that is not being collected necessarily by members of the public, it's been collected as an official data set. And the same goes for the situation in the Netherlands. If you look at OpenStreetMap and look at the border between Belgium and the Netherlands, for example, you'll see that the density of detail in the Netherlands is much, much higher than it is in Belgium. And the reason for that is that the company AND, which was basically a mapping company that offers its database to Navtech and some SatNav type system, AND have offered their data set in its entirety to OpenStreetMap. So you get the level of detail in the Netherlands, which is quite high, and again, you can see it in the metadata. We've got actually some of the tags on here, some of the indications, a laser pointer here, some of the indications as to what the purpose and the nature of these features is, prefaced with AND. So this is the Dutch database of streets, and this is the area around the Krollemuller Museum in the Hoge Veluwe National Park, and you can see that there is an extraordinarily high level of detail here. Again, not all of it captured by an individual, but much of it actually downloaded from an existing data set. So, we've got all of this data that has been collected, and as I say, my interest is primarily in the accuracy of that data, not in the fact that it is a a social geography phenomenon and to investigate the reasoning why people volunteer their services. I mean, I'm sure those are very interesting subjects to go into, but I'm looking at OpenData, VGI, from a perspective of examining its possible integration with other data sets, notably official data sets. But here are some applications for the sort of further development of some of these data sources that we have looked at. So, for example, there is an online package offered by Microsoft called PhotoSynth, where you can actually send a portfolio of images of a feature or a location in the same way as we saw that portfolio of pictures of Edinburgh tenements in the 1920s. You can submit this kind of stuff to Microsoft, and what you might well get back is a point cloud. The use of all of those images together can mimic the kind of photogrammetric applications of measurement from photographs and the establishment of coordinates. And here is an example of the output from PhotoSynth. It's a point cloud. It's a series of locations in space, three-dimensional locations in space. And if you view them from above, you've got the embryo of a map. Okay, so we are establishing the dimensions, the official and accurate dimensions, sorry, not official, the accurate dimensions of this particular feature from, in this case, 97 photographs taken around it. And we can see that the plan comes out quite readily. So that's one example of the use of image data to actually obtain coordinate information. Public image data, obtaining coordinate information. In terms of attribute information, perhaps a good example is the facility that those with TomTom sat-nav systems have. They arrive at a location to find that their sat-nav system doesn't allow them, or their sat-nav system is telling them to go in a particular direction, but reality doesn't allow them to do it. The bridge is closed, and so they throw up their hands in horror. But they then, on their instruments on the dashboard, actually do the kinds of corrections to the map. You can unlock or block a street, you can reverse traffic direction, i.e. change the direction of a one-way street, you can edit a street name, add a missing point of interest, edit a point of interest, report another error. That's the limit to what TomTom allows you to do, but once you have done that, you can send those map corrections back and you can update the centralized database. So this is citizens informing other citizens about the nature of reality outside, in particular the attributes, blocking routes and changing street names. And of course there are other applications that rely on publicly sourced data and citizen input that are perhaps much more critical than determining whether you have to go around the block in order to avoid a deviation in your route in the TomTom sat-nav system. So here we've got publicly available satellite imagery and has been used by organisations, including organisations like MapAction, in order to assess the situation after the tsunami in Sri Lanka. And this particular example, which is a very familiar example to many people, showing the open street map data before the Haitian earthquake and the situation on open street map 2 days after the earthquake in Haiti. The reason that this has become much more complex and much more complete is the fact that people went to publicly available satellite imagery, concerned citizens went to publicly available satellite imagery and basically traced off the detail that we see, making this a much more complex map and much more suitable for those people who are engaged in relief activities. So we've got examples where information is collected in reality by the citizen, and information can then be manipulated in order for us to create more up-to-date map products and potentially more accurate map products. In terms of examples of this, I'd like to add another one, which is related to INSPIRE, the information for the spatial information infrastructure for Europe. The 2007 directive specifies that the European Union will promote the creation of this spatial data infrastructure for the whole of Europe. If you read through the directive, you can't find the word citizen once. There's no indication in that directive that anybody other than official governmental bodies will be responsible for collating all of this information together. And it's clear, as we embark on a further dive into recession, that you know, the European economy will not allow for the full manifestation of INSPIRE as the directive actually expects. Is there some way in which we can use citizen source data in order to speed up, improve, complete, enhance the INSPIRE project? There's no indication of this, but I think most people are becoming quite realistic about the inability of national governments to actually contribute the funds that are going to be required in order for INSPIRE to reach its goals. So these are applications for examples of data collection and examples of applications that are using some of the data that's been collected in order to give us coordinate information that could be used for mapping purposes, could be used to update SDIs, etc. And we'll come back to a few more examples a little bit later on. So as I say, I'm particularly interested in the way in which VGI is contributing to existing projects by integrating this data that's been collected, or manipulations thereof, into the official data sources, into the governmental data, the data that's been collected by professionals. So we've seen that VGI could initiate new projects. It could help you to detect the bounds of tsunami damage in Sri Lanka. It could help you to calculate three-dimensional coordinates in a point cloud for a building that you photographed from a number of different locations. But I'm particularly interested in actually how it contributes to existing data sets, how we can use VGI to update, say, the Ordnance Survey data, how we can use it to extend, for example, British Geological Survey data, how we can integrate it into the offerings that something like INSPIRE as an SDI are going to be able to give us. So we're going to be investigating integration of data. And if we're going to do that, we need to have some idea of what parameters are going to affect our ability to integrate data, to take a data set from OpenStreetMap and merge it with Ordnance Survey data. Is that at all possible? Is it going to be acceptable to the official data supplier, the Ordnance Survey, to take on board data from other sources? Is it going to be possible for the scheme, the classification of OpenStreetMap data, to merge with the kinds of legends that the Ordnance Survey restrict our geographical reality into, different symbols, different kinds of buildings, different kinds of land use, different kinds of communication features. So there are a whole range of parameters that are going to affect that form of integration. And the first two in particular are the ones that we've looked at in the past couple of years. But it's clear that there are other ones as well. It would appear not to be a good idea to take national mapping agency data from the 1970s and try and update it with OpenStreetMap data from 2012. They're just too different in terms of their currency. But in many cases, that may be what's the only option that's available. What about completeness? Do we know that the one data set is actually completely covering the whole of a space and is therefore able to kind of slot into the official data set and replace the data that is perhaps outdated or is no longer appropriate? So there are a number of other parameters that may well affect one's judgment as to whether data can be integrated. Has it been collected to the same level of accuracy? Has it been collected by people who are reliable and responsible? But as I say, we're primarily looking at geometrical accuracy and semantic accuracy. And these are the kinds of things that would appear in the metadata, in the description of the information. And as we've seen with OpenStreetMap, you can actually you can obtain information about the method of data collection. You can get information about the classification scheme, the legend, etc. Now, there have been some experimental approaches to this in the past. There was a study by a couple of Germans who were looking at accuracy. They were looking at the accuracy of OpenStreetMap data against TeleAtlas data. Atlas information that would be used in a sat-nav system. And they looked at road links, and they found that for the most part, probably 80% of those road links, slightly more than 80% on average, were within 10 metres, the OpenStreetMap data was within 10 metres of the what they regarded as the kind of official, reliable TeleAtlas data set. So positional accuracy of OpenStreetMap data has been looked at by some people, that's one example. Giras and Toya also looked at accuracy as well, and as well as semantics. They looked at accuracy and found that from a test set of thousands of points across France, the average discrepancy between the points in official mapping and OpenStreetMap data was of the order of 7 meters. But they also looked at semantics, and this is rather difficult to see, and it's rather difficult to interpret as well. But they looked at the way in which data was classified, as well as its accuracy. They looked at whether features that were in the OpenStreetMap data set had been classified in the same way as they had been classified in other official data sets. And they found, and it's not really obvious from this particular overhead, but they found that if you took the motorways, or the autoroutes of France, then 100% of the links that were in OpenStreetMap that were called autoroute were also called autoroute in the official data set. But only 49% of the secondary roads were classed as secondary roads in the official data set, because the official data set had a fairly restrictive set of possible legend categories, whereas the OpenStreetMap data used for secondary roads a variety of terms like track and local road and back road and all of these kind of things. So the matching was much less for some features than it was for others. And then Mookie Hackley did an experiment which was reported last year, 2 years ago, Environmental Planning B, on the completeness of OpenStreetMap data. And he actually compared OpenStreetMap data to Meridian data, the Ordnance Survey data set, which, it has to be said, is not a particularly useful data set to make a comparison with, because that is very generalised. But there were some interesting maps produced by Mookie showing that in each kilometre square of the UK, in England, he did an experiment just in England, in each kilometre square in England, he measured the total length of OpenStreetMap data and compared it to the total length of Meridian data, primarily roads, and found that in some places there was more Meridian data in these red squares, and in the blue squares, OpenStreetMap actually had more total length of road links than Meridian did. Now, as I say, in certain respects, this comparison is not particularly appropriate because the Meridian data is so generalised that they will normally have much lower levels of detail, particularly in the rural areas. But these are examples of comparisons between VGI, volunteer geographic information as manifest in OpenStreetMap, and official data sources, or quasi-official data sources, in Germany, France, and in England. We tried to look at OpenStreetMap data and its comparison with Ordnance Survey data, not from the point of view of the medium and small scale data, but large scale data. By large scale, I mean large scale as it is should be known, data that is something like 1 to 2,500, 1 to 10,000, rather than small scale data, 1 to 50,000, 1 to 250,000. So we're looking at large scale data, Ordnance Survey data, typically something like MasterMap. And we are trying to compare it to OpenStreetMap, and we went into this comparison with the idea that there were going to be some factors that would affect the appearance of OpenStreetMap data, and perhaps even affect the appearance of Ordnance Survey data, affect its accuracy, affect the completeness of the data sets. There were a number of parameters that we could regard as determining factors to determine whether OpenStreetMap data was going to be closely related to Ordnance Survey data or not. So the type of feature, for example. If you've got a hard feature like a building in an urban area where the coordinates are very well defined, you can go to the corner of the building and pick it up quite easily, and you can identify that point easily on an Ordnance Survey large-scale master map plot, then clearly you would expect there to be a better match between the coordinates obtained by somebody out in the urban environment with the Ordnance Survey data than if they were potentially picking up a hedge in a rural area where it might be rather difficult to actually identify the fundamental part of the hedge, the centre line of the hedge, or the boundaries of the hedge, or whatever. So the type of feature or the nature of the landscape was one of the variables that we took into account. We also took into account the data collection method, because, although I haven't mentioned it so far, the way in which data is collected by citizens could be based on them going around with a GPS receiver, a handheld GPS receiver. They could go around with a higher grade GPS receiver. They could trace the information from imagery, from satellite imagery. So we've got a number of different data collection methods, and potentially we've got different expertise of the data collector. The official data, potentially collected by somebody who's been trained in data collection and is meeting certain standards and methods of working, compared to the data collector who is Joe Public, who's going around with their GPS receiver strapped to their bicycle and cycling along a route and potentially not understanding the nature of the GPS signal and the way in which accuracy can vary along that route. So we've got these three factors that we thought would be worth looking at as part of this particular project. And so we identified some study areas which were local to Newcastle, an urban area with hard features and a rural area with soft features. And in order to establish a kind of benchmark for our comparison of accuracies of Ordnance Survey and of OpenStreetMap data, as well as trying to see how they related to each other, we wanted to see how they related to a reference data set, a data set that we actually went and collected ourselves. So, the data in Cranlington is a built-up area, it's a new town, for want of a better term, and a rural area which has got a village in the middle of it called Claravale, which is somewhere up the River Tyne. Cranlington looks a little bit like this. And of course, being in northeast England, the sun's always shining, and it's basically a series of little boxes, okay, with hard edges and corners that you could pick up quite easily and identify features and fence corners, etc. Claravale, by comparison, looks a little bit like this, And it was rather opportune that when Google Street View cameras were actually touring around the country, they actually picked up my postgraduate student doing his GPS survey at the same time as the cameras went down this back track in the middle of nowhere. So, yes, it was quite interesting to see that Maytham is actually portrayed in the Google Street View picture. So these were the sites that we chose to compare Ordnance Survey data against OpenStreetMap data, and to compare them also to a reference data set that we went out and picked up using differential GPS, and hopefully we took sufficient care with that. I mean, it was the survey, the reference data was done by a qualified surveyor. And so hopefully we got to the situation where we had an established reference data set and we could compare the accuracy of Ordnance Survey and OpenStreetMap data against it. Now, comparing the accuracy was done using fairly standard survey techniques, one of which is the National Standard for Spatial Data Accuracy. This is a standard used by American National Mapping Agency, the USGS, and also picked up on by a number of other people, and it's been developed over decades. Some people are rather concerned about the NSSDA because it doesn't necessarily meet requirements for normality of data, and as you can see here, it just says 20 points. You know, that doesn't seem to be a very large number to actually make a comparison. But they have to be well distributed, and so we took our data and did the testing to make sure that we knew what the difference was between one data set and the other. And here are the results, so that in the urban area, between the field survey, which is our reference data set, and Ordnance Survey, the root mean standard error of those 20 points that we selected at random was relatively small. Okay, so we could say that the Ordnance Survey data matched our field survey data quite well. The field survey data, the reference data against the OpenStreetMap data, revealed a much higher figure. And of course, this is to be expected. We've suggested that the OpenStreetMap data is collected by people who are not professional surveyors. They are members of the public. And therefore, as you might expect, the accuracy of those points is much less. And the accuracy between OpenStreetMap and Ordnance Survey and OpenStreetMap data, which is the major focus of our concern, can we integrate one of these with the other? Then, as you can see, the figures sort of match the fact that Ordnance Survey is closer to the reference data set and OpenStreetMap is further away from it. And in the rural areas, as you might expect, where we've got soft detail, where you've got things like the edge of woodland and the bank of a river, which you have at Clara Vale, then the figures are slightly worse. So the difference between the Ordnance Survey data and our reference data set, as collected by Maytham with insight of the Street View cameras, was 1.8 metres. And the NSSDA standard is merely a multiplier of the root mean standard error. What about the direction of those errors? Because when you're looking at GPS, some people have done tests on the accuracy of GPS and said, well, because of the nature of the orbit and because of the way in which GPS is calculating its position, there may well be systematic errors in the north-south direction as opposed to the east-west direction. Well, we plotted these out and found that, in fact, there was little difference, or little uniformity in terms of the direction of the errors. So for the comparison between the reference data set and Ordnance Survey, we had errors going all over the place, but obviously at a relatively small level. That scale bar is 100 centimetres. The 20 points that we chose for the comparison between the reference data set and the OpenStreetMap data, 11.032 metres of the root mean standard error, so this is the scale bar here, up to 20 metres. Again, no real directionality to it. I'm sure there's a proper geographical term for isotropy, isn't it? Is that the right word? The errors were anisotropic, okay? I think that's the correct term. What about looking at the linear segments within the OpenStreetMap data as opposed to individual points? Okay, we did the same kind of tests as the Germans did. putting a buffer in around a line and seeing how much of the comparative line fell within that buffer. And so, sorry, for the comparison between the reference data set and OpenStreetMap, which is this one at the bottom here, if our buffer size was 10 metres, then approximately 90% of the data sort of matched. But if our buffer size was 2 metres, then it was only about 55% of the data matched. If we're looking at the comparison between our reference data set and Ordnance Survey, at a 2 metre buffer size, 92% of the data matched. So, once again, we're seeing the obvious conclusion that the Ordnance Survey data set is closer to the reference data set than the OpenStreetMap data set. And we then did it for area features as well, and there are a number of ways that you can characterise polygons. You can characterise them by a compactness index, which is the perimeter divided by the area, or the other way around. We use something called moments invariant, which are unitless measures of the characteristics of a polygon, its sort of elongation and its shape and its size. And so these figures don't actually mean anything. But there are 7 moments displayed here. And we can see in terms of a comparison that with the reference data set in the urban area, moment 1 has a value of about 1.85 for, that should say, ordinary survey data 1.89, but OpenStreetMap data 1.56. Now, what we did was to take those 7 moments invariant, and if anybody's interested in the formula for these, they're well established in image processing from work by Hugh and by Chen a long time ago. But we mapped these out and just showed that for moment number 1 and moment number 2, the ordnance survey with the circle and the reference data set with the square were relatively close to each other, whereas the OpenStreetMap data was a long way away. And we did that in 7-dimensional space because there are 7 moments, and we found that the distance between these 7 moment invariants for the field survey data, the reference data set, the ordnance survey, and the OpenStreetMap data showed again that the ordnance survey data was closer to the reference data set than the OpenStreetMap data was close to the reference data set. So, not really any surprise, but we've been able to quantify the discrepancy between OpenStreetMap data and our reference data set. So geometrically speaking, we felt that it was probably not appropriate at the scales that we were working at. Remember, as I say, we're dealing with large scales here. At the scales we were working at, it would be inappropriate for OpenStreetMap data to be seamlessly enmeshed with Ordnance Survey data to give us good quality spatial data at that scale. We then looked at the semantic comparison, at the way in which a feature was collected in all OpenStreetMap data and characterised as being a building of a particular type or a road of a particular type. Basically, we were looking at the legend of OpenStreetMap, and we were looking at the legend of Ordnance Survey, and we were trying to find if there was any way that you could combine these together so that you could say, okay, something that's classed as this in OpenStreetMap is actually classed as this in Ordnance Survey with 100% certainty. And clearly we had to use sort of dictionary definitions and ontologies, and we did a semantic similarity of the kinds of official and VGI data sets that we were comparing. In order to undertake that semantic similarity, we used a piece of software called WordNet, which is a project developed at Princeton University that establishes sort of sets called synsets of like features in the noun hierarchies or like actions in the verb hierarchies. And you can see here's one type of hierarchy with basically vehicles and transport as its main theme. And there are a number of these hierarchies of like defined objects, and semantic connections were established. And we tested, or WordNet tested, the relationship between features that might be called a path in OpenStreetMap and whether it matched a track in Ordnance Survey. So we tried to see whether there was a similarity, and it's graded. You get a score back from each test that you do with WordNet from 0 to 1, and we found that for 54% of the features in OpenStreetMap, I'm sorry, this isn't actually clear as to what the comparison is, but 54% of the features in OpenStreetMap Legend had 0 to 0.25, i.e. very minimal connection to features in the Ordnance Survey Legend classifications. This is just a comparison of words. And in fact, none of them had a complete comparison. For the rural areas, there was a little bit more similarity, semantic similarity between the classes. And basically what we discovered was that the OpenStreetMap Legend, this is an example of the OpenStreetMap Legend for Clara Vale, so all the features in the data set around Clara Vale are in recorded here with their type. And the Ordnance Survey Legend, which of course is standard across the whole country, basically you've got this mismatch. Okay, a track is here on the fourth level of the Ordnance Survey data set, track is on the fourth level of the OpenStreetMap data set. So there is a direct match, 100% correlation. But a path is in the Ordnance Survey data set, but there's no word for path there. There is something called footway, there is something called track. How close are they to the word path in the Ordnance Survey data set? So it's all based on dictionary definitions. And so the matching of these against each other was undertaken, and those semantic similarity scores that I mentioned were obtained. So not only do we have the meaning of the words being examined, but also we have the depth of their position in the hierarchy also being something that might well affect the way in which we try to say that something in one feature class, in one data set, is the same as something in another feature class. And so there are many sort of relationships that one could examine. You could examine, you know, one feature being directly connected to another one. Or we might, as a result of the WordNet similarity testing, say, okay, this feature is called path in one data set, and it's actually slightly related to track and to pathway in another data set. So there might be one to many and many to one, or there might be no relationship at all. And so we examined all of these kinds of semantic relationships and found that, in fact, we had very little single-type correspondence, a one-to-one matching between features. And I'm now thinking back, because I told you that track in one equaled track in another, and I'm not quite sure why I said that, because clearly it hasn't actually reflected in the results that we've got here. But certainly there appears to be significant gaps in the legend classification in one data set compared to the legend classification in another data set. That's a measure of semantic similarity. The structural similarity is a measure of the position in the hierarchy and how far down you've got to go, how far up you've got to go to come back down to find the feature somewhere in a different arm of the hierarchy. And there are ways, very straightforward ways, of measuring how far something is removed from its logical position in one data set compared to another data set. And the final kind of similarity that we were interested in was a rather less important one, because here the matching was perhaps more complete. Data type similarity, so those people who are engaged in this kind of semantic similarity are interested in data type similarity. If something is recorded as a string feature in one legend classification and is put in as, a date data type in another classification, then that's obviously a difference. Whereas if it's classified as an integer, as a data type in one data set, an integer in another one, then there is more of a matching. So we regarded the meaning of the individual words, their position in the hierarchy of the legend, and the type of way in which they were recorded, as strings of characters, characters or dates or integers, etc. We regarded these as three distinct ways of measuring similarity. And we basically just combined them together and thought up some weights and basically came up with an overall similarity score. And that overall similarity score showed obviously some differences in the urban data, the rural data, etc. Now, we therefore were convinced that the nature of the area was a fairly important determinant of how well things matched geometrically and also how well things matched semantically as well, because in the rural areas things seem to be matched a little bit better than they were in the urban areas. And probably the reason for that is that there are more things that you can identify in an urban area, there are more things that you can classify, or there are more classes that you can apply. And one of the characteristics about OpenStreetMap data, and somebody mentioned this to me only 2 days ago, they said that OpenStreetMap data is anarchic in terms of its classification. Nominally, anybody who puts in a definition of a class of feature, okay, I want to invent a new feature that, or develop a new class of feature that I can identify in my urban data set of, I know, greengrocer shop. It's not there, nobody else has used it before, but I want to do it. Nominally, they should actually put this open to the vote, and people should be allowed to vote as to whether that joins the legend categories. But in fact, it never happens, and therefore, the legend categories that you see on OpenStreetMap data burgeon enormously, and you've got a whole range of different features that are called different things, even though they may well be the same type of feature. So there's no standardization there, and so our feeling was that the hard features are potentially more capable of being classified into a wider range of different classes than the softer features. And we did a factorial analysis on the three factors, the number of contributors. So this was trying to basically, I suppose, analyse why there were differences in the accuracies, both geometric and semantic accuracies. This law called Linus's law says that the more people that you have contributing to a data set, the more reliable it is. Now, some people might argue the reverse, but if you can identify the individuals who are responsible for contributing to OpenStreetMap data, then you are going to be able to make some judgment on the quality of that data. The nature of the area, as I said, the method of data collection. Was this data collected in the field by Joe Public just standing at the corner of a building and using his GPS receiver? Or was it collected by somebody actually tracing the outline of a building off some publicly available satellite imagery? We found that data source was the major influence. That the differences in accuracy between data sets was more if the feature had been traced from remote sensing data than if somebody had gone out into the field. And the differences were greater than the differences between hard and soft features, or indeed the number of people who were contributing to the data set.
Sorry, I just wanted to say that the photograph was worse.
Yes, absolutely, yes, yes, yeah, and significantly worse. Yeah. There was a bigger difference there than there was with the other factors. So that in some senses, I suppose on reflection, is a positive thing to take from this study, because it means that if you've got data that you know has been collected by field techniques rather than just being traced off imagery, as much OpenStreetMap data is, then you potentially are moving to a situation where it will align more closely with the official data than it would otherwise do. And in fact, we did testing of this in Baghdad because we felt that here was an opportunity for a situation where citizen source data would be of great benefit. I mean, there is a national mapping agency in Iraq at the moment. It's called the General Directorate of Survey. It is basically frozen in time. It hardly exists. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't do much work. It's a shadow of its former self. And most of the data that it supplies has been given to it by Americans who have been busy mapping Iraq for a number of years now, as you might imagine. So we did a test on OpenStreetMap and the General Directorate of Survey, against a reference data set. So as I say, my postgraduate Matham, who we last saw in a field in Clara Vale, actually went in, and very brave of him to do so, went in and actually did some field survey in environments like this in Baghdad and picked up a reference data set in the urban area of Baghdad. Now, this might look a little bit dramatic to say that he was doing, you know, he's doing his survey in these kind of areas, because in fact most of his survey was on the university campus in Baghdad, which seems to be, I've never been there, but it looks to be quite a nice place actually. But he did actually do a mixture of you know, dense urban areas and open spaces like that. And what we came up with was a similar kind of testing to the testing that we did before, the root mean standard error, the calculation of the national standard for spatial data accuracy, and in fact, the figures that we got are relatively similar to the figures that we got for the urban areas in the, well, maybe not quite similar, but 1.24 I thought was quite good for the difference between the official survey data of Iraq and our reference data set. The OpenStreetMap data, it is known by looking at the metadata, was collected by tracing from rectified Yahoo satellite imagery. And in fact, it's not too bad, considering. I mean, that's an order of magnitude similar to what we got in the Clara Vale area. Again, the direction of the errors was not a factor. I forgot to put in, I meant to put this in this morning, but we did do a semantic similarity test with the classifications of OpenStreetMap against GDS classes. That was somewhat complicated by the fact that, as you might imagine, the General Directorate of Survey legend was in Arabic. So we had to do a test or a separate step in order to convert that from Arabic into English, because in fact the OpenStreetMap data for Baghdad is only classified in English. It's not classified in Arabic at all. It's only classified, the legend classes are in English. So we needed, in order to make this test realistic and comparable with the British situation, we had to translate the legend categories of the official data from Arabic into English. And we came up with very similar results to the kind of results that we got with the Ordnance Survey against OpenStreetMap in this country. The burgeoning number of classes of OpenStreetMap data in Baghdad meant that the similarity scores, the semantic similarity scores, were fairly bad, as they were in the UK. So, our conclusion is that the data that we tested revealed certain problems in matching OpenStreetMap data and Ordnance Survey data in both the kind of areas that we studied, hard areas and soft areas, and with different data sources, with data that was obtained from Landsat data, Landsat tracing, and we found plenty data in the UK bits of OpenStreetMap data that had as their source Landsat data, which obviously is very low resolution, and therefore was giving us fairly low levels of accuracy. And the semantic accuracy was also problematic, and it would be very difficult for us to take data from the OpenStreetMap legend and bring it seamlessly into the Ordnance Survey legend. I mentioned that we might see a few more examples, and I just put forward three, just to sort of summarise where things might be going in terms of this kind of approach. Natural England, I was just discussing this with William earlier, that there is a responsibility on people to record invasive species. The 1959 Weeds Act, there is such a thing, is actually forbids you from planting things like the stuff that's poisonous to horses, I forget what it's called, yellow flower that you see. Ragwort, the very stuff, yes. You're not allowed to plant that in your fields. In fact, I think you explicitly have to get rid of it. Japanese knotweed, which is a big problem, I think, in many places, I don't think it's illegal to have it growing on your land, but again, you're not allowed to plant it. And so Natural England, which is interested in the distribution and the spread of crop, of plants like ragwort and Japanese knotweed, are keen to get citizens involved in mapping this kind of stuff, in picking up information, determining where there is an occurrence of these kinds of forbidden plants, and actually recording it locally. So environmental monitoring is an obvious way in which citizens can contribute their data. But if they're wanting to do it at large scale, if they're wanting to plot that occurrence of ragwort on master map data as a backdrop, then they may well come against problems because of the geometric inaccuracies of the data that they collect. Mapping of informal settlements in Kibera. Here's an example of somebody creating a data set of roadkill, I think, in California. A very close examination of the hedgehog on the road. This is citizen science, okay? The location is mapped. This is part of environmental monitoring, okay? He is a Californian after all. Kibera is an area, a slum area in Nairobi, which is a blank space on the official Kenyan survey maps. Under the leadership of a chap called Michael Maron, I think, people were trained to go in, locals were trained to go in and pick up detail in their area. And this is really a very good example of citizen-based initiatives in mapping the facilities of this slum area in Nairobi, which I believe has a population of over 1 million in its own right. But you can also see that not only have they accurately, well, we assume that they've accurately, I mean, we can't test it because there's no official data in this area at all. But in addition to actually developing the geographical layout of features like railways and footways and buildings and open spaces, they've actually attributed the kinds of features here that you wouldn't normally see on an official national mapping agency map. Okay, so we've got lots of toilets everywhere. We've got standpipes. We've got barber shops and kerosene pumps, chemists and churches, and the Drug Fighters Primary School, which sounds a very nice name for somewhere, and the railway, etc. So we've got features in here that don't actually appear on official data. And again, I think this is something that is showing where citizen source data is going, where you're not actually doing it in order to integrate it with existing official sources, but you're doing it in order to get new information from the landscape. The final example that I've said here is one that I've got a postgraduate working on at the moment. And it's one of the reasons why we were so concerned with large-scale data. I mean, it's obvious that OpenStreetMap data was never meant to be displayed at 1 to 2,500, 1 to 10,000. And what we've done is to show that, indeed, it's not really possible to use OpenStreetMap data at those large scales. But imagine that you're in a shanty town in Nigeria and you want to put in a sewage system. You want to bring in some sanitation to the area. And as a citizen, what can you do in order to ensure that that goes ahead? Well, one of the things you could do is to actually map the area in such a way that the sanitation engineer can then plan the sewage system that they're going to put in. Is there a way in which the citizens are going to be able to match the specification that a sanitation engineer wants in terms of their mapping? Okay, engineering plans at 1 to 480 scale. Is a typical specification for somebody who's putting in a sewage system, because you need to have that level of accuracy to make sure that you are building pipes and inspection chambers, etc., in relation to the existing infrastructure and the existing housing and the existing property boundaries in an effective way. And when it comes to doing sewage, of course, elevation is particularly important, because you want to make sure that your sewer actually does drain away. And so height is very important, and any of you who have used GPS will know that the height accuracy in the third dimension is 10 times worse than planimetric accuracy in X and Y. And it therefore might seem to be almost impossible for somebody as a citizen equipped with a handheld GPS receiver, or more likely in Africa a mobile phone that's got a GPS receiver in it, is it possible for them to actually get accurate height information in order to help a sanitation engineer? We don't know that. Well, that's what my postgraduate is working on, so we tell him that we don't know the answer to that yet, and that's what his PhD is going to be about. So hopefully he will find something to investigate there. This kind of citizen source data is also being considered by BGS, and again, I was talking about this earlier, the fact that you know, there are occurrences in the natural environment that are of interest to organisations like BGS, who are responsible not just for the archival record of the solid geology, but events that happen within the natural environment, like earthquakes. And if you can get citizens actually reporting earthquakes, then that could be useful data to supplement seismological observations with. But I just caution you that, that last week, 13th of January 2012, many people from Berwick down to Newcastle, in fact it says there from Eyemouth down to Sunderland, phoned BGS to say that there'd been an earthquake in the area, but in fact it was a sonic boom. So the accuracy of the data that has been provided by the citizens was perhaps somewhat lacking there, and that's obviously a major factor in the take-up of this kind of citizen source data. So, this is my last slide, and it summarises and says that really we have to tread cautiously here. It has been said that what we are doing at the moment, potentially with this link to Natural England and to British Geological Survey and to sanitation engineering, we are crowdsourcing science, and that might be something that we need to do in future to meet the expectations of INSPIRE, for example. We need to crowdsource scientific endeavour. But as soon as you put that kind of aphorism in, the opposite aphorism comes in, that in order to be able to do that successfully, you have to address the science of crowdsourcing. You can undertake the crowdsourcing of science, but in order to do it effectively, you need to address the science of crowdsourcing. Is it giving you accurate data? Is it giving you reliable data? Is it giving you complete data? You need to take these kinds of things into account. Now, what we've seen is that, in fact, it's very much dependent on the application area, is dependent on what you're actually using this crowdsourced data, or potentially using this crowdsourced data for. We've got this distinction that's made in crowdsourcing circles between active data, where people actually physically go out and collect the data and send it in, and passive data, which is you just going along with your TomTom or your sat-nav system, and not without your knowledge, but certainly automatically your route is downloaded to the Navtech database, okay, and that can be used to detect things like traffic holdups and allow you then to perhaps navigate around them. But that's passive data. That's not actively contributed to by the people who are actually going out and taking OpenStreetMap data and recording the corners of buildings, etc. And that passive crowdsourcing is something that is really rather important, because there's a great deal more passive crowdsourcing than there is active data sourcing. And you know, anybody who drives around with a sat nav may well be contributing indirectly to data sets with Navtech, for which there's no metadata, for which there's little apart from just a stream of coordinates. And we've got the variability of data collection and reality. We still go back in our project to this difference between the nature of what you're actually collecting. Are you collecting hard detail that traditionally has been the kind of detail that national mapping agencies have collected, and therefore they've got established means of doing it, and they do it to a very high standard of accuracy? Or are you collecting new data, data with different classes, soft data, data that's environmental and potentially is maybe even disappears after a short time? And what we may get is a situation where we end up with high quality and low quality databases. And to me, that would be a fairly difficult situation to contend with, because you would then have further discussion about which applications each of these can be used for. It has to be said that some people have written about crowdsourcing in such a way that says the science of crowdsourcing is not a physical science, but it's more of a social science, and that we should get away from trying to measure accuracy. We should get away from this idea of saying, well, you can't combine the legends together, and you should look at crowdsourced data in terms of the way it was collected and who collected it and how dynamic it is and whether a lot of data is coming in at once. So things that are going to characterise crowdsourced data sets are not the stamp of accuracy, not the stamp of completeness, not the stamp of currency, but the stamp of saying a lot of people actually contributed to this data. Or this data is soft data, and therefore, you know, we're not expecting it to be highly accurate in terms of its positional location. This data has been collected by a whole lot of people within a day, and therefore it's up to date and it's contemporary, and people have been interested enough to go out and collect it, data about earthquakes and that kind of thing. So the answer to that last question is, of course, it depends on a whole number of circumstances. But I think the future for crowdsourcing is one where perhaps we're moving away from this very mechanistic approach of accuracy testing and trying to determine how well something matches against a reference standard, which is what we've been doing for the past 2 years. And we're moving into a situation where there are somewhat more nebulous characteristics of data sets being used in order to determine the utility of crowdsourcing data. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Now, question right in there.
Yeah. In measuring accuracy, you've used the methodology of comparing multiple sources against each other.
Yeah.
I wonder if you've also looked at the internal consistency of a single source, because where the data is redundant, you may have multiple ways of calculating the same piece of information, and then you could measure to what extent they agree. And I can see that particularly in the geometric area or anything that's quantitative, you may have different ways of measuring where some object appears because you have different routes to it.
Yeah.
But even in crowdsourcing, I think, or qualitative data, it may be that different people have labelled objects in different ways. I mean, supposing you had instance a road, and one end of it somebody had labelled as a B road and the other end as an A road. It may have changed.
Yes. Not really, but you're right to raise that, because I mean, this idea that Linus's law states that the more people you've got contributing to a data set, the more accurate it's going to be. I mean, clearly the opposite pertains in the circumstance that you mentioned, because there's more chance that people are going to disagree when it comes to combining data together in that way. And of course, even there's internal consistency, I'm sure, even within ordnance survey practices. I mean, potentially, I suppose, you could say that the whole of our data set in Cramlington and the whole of our data set in Clara Vale were obtained in the same technique using photogrammetric data based on restituted aerial photographs, which are based on control points and everything. So in that sense, I think there is some consistency. But the more diverse the ways in which you can collect the data, whether it's through tracing from satellite data or GPS using different standards of receiver and different accuracies, yeah, potentially you've got more, you've got lack of uniformity within the data set.
You might be able to recover some version of Linus's law if you had a way of combining inconsistent data. I read the other day, there's one story about Gauss and his invention of the Gaussian.
Yes.
Lots of people trying to estimate the position of Neptune, and there were many different things, and he plotted them, and they were essentially a bell curve.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably there, and
yes.
It was.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, that's one of the things that the national, I mean, just to diverge a little bit, the National Standard of Spatial Accuracy, National Standard of Spatial Data Accuracy, many people have criticised it because they're only using 20 points and you can't really get an efficient normal distribution through 20 points. I'm not quite sure how you sort of normalise the distribution of classes of whether it's an A road or a B road or something like that. But in terms of geometric accuracy, yeah, you could examine a whole range of different contributors to the coordinate position of a point. And certainly, you know, there are worries of, you know, Ordnance Survey, for example, outsourcing some of its data collection to places like India, where potentially they're using a different flow line to capture the data. And you know, the merging of that updated data that's been sampled in a distant place, in Denmark or in India, and merging that with the existing Ordnance Survey data set is an example of the kind of thing that we think perhaps should be frowned upon, to taking data from these different sources and saying, oh yeah, it's equally valid as an update. But you're right, there is potential internal inconsistency in the data.
Couple there, right in the back, Stuart.
Do you think it's possible to find a limit in the accuracy of the crowdsourced data in each, or that it could be improved in these networks to bring it to the OS?
Well, as I've said, the number of ways of collecting crowdsourced data appear to be numerous, and if you go to the metadata on OpenStreetMap, you can see that some people have collected it with some instrument and some people have connected with a different instrument. You know, a handheld Garmin that you can buy off the shelf for £99 may well give you a very different answer to something much more precise and much more scientific. So unless you equip everybody with the most scientifically advanced things, the answer is no, there's always room for improvement of this. But as I said right at the end, I'm not sure whether that path of trying to ensure maximum geometric accuracy is actually the way forward for crowdsourcing. I think there are other ways in which crowdsourcing is being characterised, and although it pains me to say it, as somebody from a geomatics background, I think that the accuracy is in fact becoming less and less important, and therefore people are not necessarily striving for maximum accuracy. And many people are very happy just to trace off satellite imagery, because you know it looks complete if they do that. They can say, "Oh, look at the amount of features I've managed to pick up," you know, just an hour in front of the computer digitizing on screen. And you know, it's. I think that GPS observations are becoming more accurate. I mean, the instrumentation is becoming better, and so in that sense, you know, if you're using GPS instruments to capture your data, you are going to, you know, in a steady way, improve the precision of the data sets. But as I say, I think the science of crowdsourcing is moving on to other areas.
From Ben now.
Yeah, I was going to talk about satellite imagery. When you think of the Earth, I mean, you're talking about there's different satellite imagery you can use. Mm. Is it some more like a visitor's? Or are you talking about errors in digitizing process, I suppose, or lack of visibility, shadows? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's
not geographic.
All of those. I mean, basically, I mean, you just listed the kind of things that affect the accuracy of data that you can collect from satellite imagery. There's the resolution of the imagery, and as I say, some. I mean, you go to OpenStreetMap, and some of it says, you know, this has been traced from Landsat data, you know, ETM data, 30 meter resolution. It's clear that you're not going to get accurate positions from that. There is the interpretation of the image by the person who's digitizing it. There is the level of restitution of the imagery, whether it is georeferenced accurately, whether there is any height distortions and all of that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, it's just the normal sort of errors that you find in satellite data. But I mean, the stuff that was traced for Haiti, you know, 2 days after the earthquake.
You argue if anybody's doing it, the same thing.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Well, that's right. I mean, that was one scene, I would imagine, and I would imagine that there was significant duplication there, so you might well have ended up in a situation where Linus's law did apply, and OpenStreetMap actually just averaged out. I must admit, I don't know how it was done, but certainly the map that was produced in Port-au-Prince was of significant value to the people who were going in there. I mean, clearly, because you were not on the ground, And in fact, I think a lot of this digitizing was done at MIT, where they had some expat Haitians who were able to remember the names of streets and that kind of thing, because that kind of stuff would obviously not be able to be picked up from the satellite imagery.
Okay,
I'll
just
speak to it. More of an observation and a question, but actually we had the Edinburgh chap from OpenStreetMap in this very room towards the start of this year.
Oh, really? Right, okay.
And so that was quite... So after that, I don't know if anybody else did, I kind of blind up after the talk, went back and logged on, created my OpenStreetMap idea and got into the system and looked up my sort of area and stuff like that and did my, well, I did my bit, I went in and had a look and see what it's about. And my observation was it's kind of the internal, if this is a mashup idea, which the OS Gradient data set is as well, it's stuff from different scales all mashed up together and spewed out as another nominal scale or whatever. But what I was interested in was looking at was bus stops. Mm. For example, all the bus stops are in, presumably from the council or something or put them in. But they weren't beside the roads. they were in a few metres. They were relatively accurate. So one side, if there were two bus stops were on opposite sides of the road, then there were two bus stops up that were either a couple of metres apart or whatever, but both of them were skewed off somewhere in houses with the side of it. And that kind of consistent. It wasn't just they were in the wrong, those parts of the map had been in the wrong place, but just kind of internal inconsistency of the data set. So they're actually, this is the idea of map, as you were talking about at the very start, that the graphic content, such as images, people want, and they can do the sort of spatial interpretation, whatever, can go in GIS 1.0 up there in the brain. But when that graphical image is going to be internally inconsistent, so you're the ones going, well, I'm going to go for a bus in an unfamiliar area, for example, then where is it actually the bus stop? Like, it's not actually on the street.
Yes, you're right. I mean,
that makes it less useful.
Yeah. I mean, I drove down the A1 on a coach a couple of weeks ago, and the coach driver had his sat-nav on, but it was obviously an out-of-date data set because the A1 has now been made into motorway. So the whole time we were going southwards, we were not on a road. And every road that came across, it said turn right and then turn left onto the A1 because the A1 was over here. But of course, as you say, people's own intelligence and interpretation would say, okay, yeah, I realise there's an error in the data, and I know what the data is meaning to say, that there is a bus stop in this area. The fact that it's put it, 5 metres, in the wrong place is something I can cope with.
Well, I think it's wrong place. The bus stop is probably in the right place.
All right.
In terms of spatial accuracy, if you looked at the grid references, went behind the thing and actually worked out what the grid reference. Trying to find it, right. Look at the data, the grid reference of that, right? Possibly giving you the nature of the content of your talk about how inaccurate everything else is. It's possibly everything else is in the wrong place, but the bus stops spatially are in the right place. So actually, you don't need to move the bus. I ended up moving the bus stops, but actually, I should have kept the bus stops, but I used them as a reference point and moved everything else.
So, did you
select all and just shift it?
You recorded that edit, did you? And
I thought, yeah.
Because, of course, the moderation of this kind of data would be an enormous job for somebody. And so there are ideas as to how to moderate. I mean, Wikipedia has had these kind of issues, for many years. And so there are issues as to how to characterise the quality of the data by who submitted it and whether people sort of vote to accept it or all of these kind of ways of doing it. But, that's just another layer of infrastructure on top of the system.
But the problem with Wikipedia, then, you've got facts and opinions. So where something is factual, either it's correct or it's not. So that's a measure of... opinion or whatever, possibly. But when this stuff is concerned, where the OpenStreetMap is concerned, then yes, you can be looking at it, but if you want to use it in a system, your GIS or whatever, when you're doing other things on top of it, or whatever, then that's completely different sort of use of the data. data and actually the how important it is.
I'll skip quickly over mentions of Wikipedia as
well. No.
Really interesting talk, Dave, thank you for that. And actually, to sort of echo Angus's point, I think it was a very good follow-on from the one we had from the he clearly was sort of saying, isn't this marvellous, but actually had no answers to the questions we were asking about the very things that you've answered. So I thought that was an excellent talk. I'm going to ask you a slightly naughty question. And that's about the issue of plagiarism.
Yes.
It inspired by the fact that for our building, you came up with a label, which was Institute of Geography, New Surgical Hospital, (close brackets). Mm-hmm. And I know where that's come from, and it's not come from the door right there, it's come from my database.
Right.
Fine. Because that's the only place that label would appear. Cartographers, of course, have this very naughty tradition over hundreds of years of being terrible plagiarists.
Yes,
indeed. And you said yourself that in terms of the imagery data, it's dead easy to go in and start capturing image data. How do you know in the measurements you've made that have compared OpenStreetMaps with Oregon Survey data that somebody hasn't gone in and, highly illegally of course, digitised the Oregon Survey data because they didn't realise that wasn't something they should be doing?
Yeah. The only way that we've been able to do that with OpenStreetMap data in the UK, I think it's relatively straightforward to do that because the metadata record does give an audit trail and it tells you who did it and how they did it and when they did it. I suppose somebody could invent the fact that they cycled out and captured these points using a Garmin GPS or something, but that's what's on record.
So it does actually tell you.
Yes.
Yes.
We've been in contact with the people who have actually who are listed as the data suppliers, the data collectors for the data in Cramlington and Clara Vale, and they've said yes, this is what we've done, and this is how we did it. But you're right. I mean, there is. Yeah, there's significant scope for people to trace off Google Maps, for example. And that's illegal because, I mean, that's not a public data source. It has got copyright restrictions on it. The OpenStreetMap data is a Creative Commons license and you are allowed to use it for particular purposes. But you're right, how that data is actually sourced, and the OpenStreetMap data for Baghdad, again, we were able to look at the metadata and see that data came from, I mean, it says source Landsat. So we're assuming, and maybe it is a rash assumption, that the person actually traced it off the satellite imagery. Obviously, satellite imagery that has been licensed in such a way that you're allowed to add value to it in this way. The guy could have been, completely... guy or girl could have been completely false about where they got that information from, and it could have been from a direct copy of official data sources. And I must admit, I was surprised at how close the Baghdad data was, how low the root mean standard error figures were, considering the fact that it was meant to have been traced from Landsat data. So maybe it did come from a copyright source.
I think I probably agree with you. It's actually recorded, this has come from Landsat data,
yeah. But you're right, in terms of the actual entries for those fields, like the name of this building, I don't think there's any information about, just trying to think about the metadata for the OpenStreetMap is normally metadata about the coordinate information. The attribute information, could come from.
Actually, I don't mind in that case because it's sensible we all call the thing the same name. It's just rather interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that you've been able to identify that as the source. Yeah.
I'm an expert at spotting plagiarism.
Yeah. Your students have taken note of that comment.
Yes, I'm just saying.
Any more?
Yeah. Yes.
Perhaps we should thank Mr. Gordon.
his duties, so perhaps we'll draw it to a close. I should just say that, yes, I found it interesting early January looking at some of the OS data, Meridian and strategy, and seeing that some things on, well, mostly the strategy was better, or you know, seemed to fit the colour raster, which of course then tells a different story. So who knows what comes from where. But and there is, you know, resisting filling in the blanks in one data set, I suppose we can get away with it in our ivory tower with our various license agreements. But worth having a look. Anyway, I should thank David once again. Before we do, I think, are we going to retire?
Yeah, possibly bar, I guess.
TV at Library Bar for anyone who would like to join us. Thanks all again for coming. The next talk is the 3rd of February. That's Andy Whiteman, so that should be quite popular. So if we get to you early for that one, we'll get some seating in the middle. But other than that, I'd just like to thank you all again and thank David.